But what is really concerning me is, why aren't more people coming to the meeting tomorrow?
Well, Paul, it's not just a contemporary problem. Down through history, people have avoided consciously what their subconscious tells them they should face up to. Let me give you an example. When the Grand Inquisitors came to challenge Galileo about his contention that the earth revolved around the sun rather than what had been accepted orthodoxy for centuries, he said, "Look into my telescope and you'll see what I see." And their response to him was, "We will not look into the telescope because we cannot see what is not there." You see, people will avoid the evidence of truth at all costs, even if it costs them their freedom, and if it costs them their intellectual life, whatever. But there's this tendency on the part of too many people to avoid confrontation with truth.
And to me, it was one of the more important speeches I've ever heard, and maybe one of the most important speeches I'll ever hear. And I wanted my family to hear that. I wanted my close friends to hear that. So, hence the meeting today. So, why don't we welcome to West Texas, Mr. Larry Abraham.
Thank you, Paul. Ladies and gentlemen, it's been a number of years since I was in Midland. I was thinking as I was flying in here the other day, been 15 years since I was in Midland. A lot of changes up and down in that time. One thing never changes for a person who grew up in Western Washington with mountains and trees. It never ceases to amaze me how flat it is here. I know when you come over that border, you could drop a bowling ball and it'd roll all the way to Mexico without stopping. But it's a pleasure for me to be with you today. And when Paul Thorpe extended the invitation, I certainly welcomed the opportunity. And prior to the first time I gave this presentation in La Jolla, just outside San Diego, somebody asked me, "Well, Larry, what are you going to speak about?" Most speeches have a title. I'm still wrestling with a title on this one. I call this my Creation of the World and Subsequent Events speech. And if you think I'm kidding, wait till you get done with it. You will see that that's precisely what we do in this talk. Because we live in an age where the worldview concept that an individual has been lost. It wasn't that many years ago when you talk about somebody, a contemporary or person of recent memory, and people would ask quite naturally, "Well, what's his philosophy?" You never hear that question asked anymore. What's his or her philosophy? We have become a philosophically dead age. And while most people, when they think of philosophy, if they think about it at all, they reflect back to maybe philosophy 101 or a logic class in college and an instant yawn. But it shouldn't be that way. Because the philosophy that a person holds, a philosophy that a people holds, becomes the philosophy that a society, a culture, a nation holds. And therein lies the continuity from the creation of the world through subsequent events. So what I'm going to share with you today is my worldview. And what I think, at least in part, may be your worldview, or maybe we will generate some thoughts and ideas that will help you form a worldview. We come to these things quite naturally. But in the process of coming to them, there are usually great big gaping holes. Paul mentioned in his introduction that I spoke a lot on college campuses, and I did in the 60s and the 70s. And I remember speaking in the early 60s. At that time, you could go before a college audience, particularly of juniors and seniors, and you could refer to a philosophical school of thought. And generally, the upperclassmen would know what you meant. You could refer to a particular economic school of thought, and they would know what you meant. By the 70s, you could take nothing for granted. Even with graduate school collegians, the idea of what had framed their, quote, philosophy had been lost. And such is the case today. When I leave West Texas tomorrow, I fly to Houston to meet my son, Joseph, who graduated last night from the University of Puget Sound. He started off as a philosophy major. And when I talked to him a little bit about where the philosophy profs were picking up the thread of what they were teaching him and his classmates, I was appalled. Normally, if you're going to talk about the epistemology or the development of an idea, it's logical to start at the beginning and work your way forward. They dropped them right down in the middle of about the 18th century and never let them look back. Now, that may not seem significant yet, but I submit before the day is over, it will. Now, when you develop a philosophy, a worldview, as it were, you develop also your own perception of reality. The ages-old and standard I am, who am, I think, therefore I am, René Descartes. People have been debating, you know, what constitutes a perception of reality. And in today's age, probably the most lost ingredient in the perception of reality is what we could call common sense. The sophists among us, the perpetual sophomores, can literally talk people out of anything, as we shall see. So we're talking about how we perceive reality, how it shapes our philosophy, how it shapes our society, and consequently, our political process. Now, getting to know and appreciate the difference between right and wrong is probably the most compelling question facing contemporary man. The difference between right and wrong. G.K. Chesterton, the great 19th century and 20th century critic, writer, said all arguments, both historical and contemporaneously, boil down to one idea. The acceptance or the rejection of the doctrine of original sin. If you put it in a religious context, take it out of a religious context, put it totally in a secular context, and the argument's still the same. Is man basically good, or is man basically evil? That's the argument. All of society is built around one or the other of those concepts. And you can talk till you fall over in a dead faint. You can listen to the apologists on the 6 o'clock news rattle on for hours, but it sooner or later gets down to that one. Are we living in an age, in an era, where we believe that man is inherently evil or man is inherently good? And once we accept one or the other, what do we do about it? What are the strictures? What are the ideas? What are the political frameworks? How do we conduct our own life in light of that? That is the eternal question. And people want to back away from it all the time. They would prefer not have to not have to come to grips with that one. Now, we're going to explore these ideas. And we're going to show you how they have developed in what we call Western civilization. Because today, Western civilization, the culture that includes Western civilization, is under attack. You recall the chant at Stanford a couple of years ago? Jesse Jackson there with the Stanford students, hey, hey, ho, ho, Western culture's got to go. Once a people reject their culture, they ultimately reject everything that that culture entails. Rejecting the concept of the value of a citizenship within the framework of a culture, that's an easy step. That's an easy process. Once the cultural rejection has started to permeate our perceptions of reality. Today you hear all sorts of arguments. Well, Western culture, brutalized all these wonderful primitive cultures. Every primitive culture somehow has been elevated right up there to sanctity in the last few years. Probably the best example I can give you is the one you've probably all seen, is Dances with Wolves. There the Indians were saintly, and the whites were brutal. And anything smacking of Western culture, Western civilization, the expansion of Western civilization, the manifest destiny, as it was called in the 19th century, was brutal, uncaring, evil, and the primitive Sioux culture was sanctified. We see the same thing going on all over the world. So we have to ask ourselves, we have to understand what is at stake here. Is our culture worth defending? But before we can even answer that question, we have to discern how we got to where we are. Where did we come from? Now, when you take a look at any civilization, you can compare it to a three-stage rocket. And let me show you what I mean graphically. Imagine, if you will, you got a rocket that's stage one. Second stage, booster. Stage two. And then finally, three. As we survey those cultures or civilizations of the past, we will find that how far stage three goes, how high it can be propelled, in the way of material progress, or what the philosophers like to call that thin fabric of civilization, directly relates to these two. A society, it's impossible for a society to provide a lot of material progress, or let's put it in common, a good standard of living, unless there's something that preceded it. Now, what precedes it will determine how high that standard of living can be propelled. But remember, in stage three, there is no propellant. Stage three is operating off the momentum of the other two. And the primary thrust is in stage one. And what constitutes thrust for a civilization? It's theology. And it's philosophy. Because all philosophies are an extension of theology. And when we talk about theology, let's again be very simple. We're talking about how does a person, a society, view them, their relationship with God, small g or even capital G, and what sort of philosophical statements do they draw out of that theological belief? If there is what the Greeks called the content of right reason, if it squares up with reality, then this stage can provide a great deal of thrust, which sets the stage for the second, or sets the condition for the second stage. Here's where you get into the what they call the practical studies of economics, sociology, etc. It's impossible for these to be developed in a sophisticated fashion unless these precede it, and how right these are will determine how right reason mandates these. And then, out of that comes stage three, the momentum that creates a better way of life. Man's material progress, let's call it that. MMP. Remember that, we're going to come back to that. So, in taking a look at it through the eyes of a historian, you will see that all civilizations that made their mark did so because of how closely they came to a proper understanding here. Some of them started off in the right direction and then got waylaid. But when we examine our own theology and consequent philosophy, what do we find? If you go back to the Old Testament, the Hebrew scholars, Abraham, Moses, the rabbis, that would be the basis for a philosophy growing out of a theology. Pure and simple. And what did that theology say? That theology, in essence, said man is responsible for his actions. And all valid or quasi-valid theologies have that in common. Ancient and pagan theologies don't believe that, didn't believe that, still don't believe that. Thus, a plethora of gods who affect their life. They believe, the ancients believed, and unfortunately a lot of college professors today believe, that there are these forces at work over which they have no control. The god who flooded the Nile, the god who brings the sun up, and the god who brings the moon, and the god who brings the rain. And that the most important thing man could do was not think in terms of his own responsibilities, but don't make the gods mad. So therefore, ancient and pagan societies always have shamans or witch doctors whose primary goal and responsibility to their fellow man is to show them how not to make the gods mad. And if you take a look at, okay, let's separate it away from the Judeo-Christian for a minute. Let's take a look at the ancient Oriental philosophy, Confucianism. The similarities between Confucianism and Judeo-Christianity as it relates to how an individual views their own responsibilities are dramatic, and created a philosophy that created a great culture, the remnant of which is still here today, 6,000 years later. You can read Confucius and actually be almost awed by the sanctity of what he says. All great theologies have one thing in common. How do they view the individual's actions and the consequences of same? Again, see, we're ratcheting back to the idea of original sin. Now, when you go looking for the antecedents of Western culture, you can see that it is basically two things. On the religious track, it has its origins in Judaism, and the Greek philosophical school. But the Greeks were affected by the early Hebrews as well. Remember, the Greek philosophical school didn't really grow up until about the 3rd century B.C. with Socrates, followed by Plato, followed by Aristotle. And if you want an accurate description of what constitutes Western culture, as one wag said it, it was when Thomas Aquinas baptized Aristotle. The fact that they lived 900 years apart, or excuse me, 1300 years apart, didn't mean anything, but the Aristotelian idea was codified by Thomas Aquinas. And thus the basis for the welding of our theological, philosophical schools of thought that constitute Western culture. And my poor son Joseph, I feel less sorry for him than I do many of his classmates. Can you imagine being a philosophy major and never reading Aristotle or Thomas Aquinas? Is it any wonder that you can get Stanford students to stand out and shout, hey, hey, ho, ho, Western culture's got to go? You know why they don't teach it? Because the professors don't know it. Professors only teach that which they know. They're like any other species. They proceed from their own kind. In the philosophical schools of the Greeks and the Old Testament lessons, you have what we now can call the wisdom of the ages. You would be hard put. Any serious student would be hard put to read a proverb of Solomon's, an axiom of Confucius, and be able to tell you who said what. The similarities are that great. And while that may seem interesting, what's most interesting about it is the effect it had on the culture of the respective areas of the world where those ideas gained ascendancy. And then take the discourses of Epictetus, little, short little ideas, thoughts. We're familiar, most of us are at least familiar in name with Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, but how many are familiar with Epictetus? I commend to you the discourses of Epictetus. It's not heavy sledding, it's just very, very important and insightful reading. And in every instance, you will find this continuing similarity between the major thinkers of their respective age. Is man inherently good, or is man inherently evil, and what do we do about it? Today we live in an age where the progressives, and I put that in quotes, say that morality is not a constant, but it is evolving, just like the species itself, and that what was good yesterday may not be good tomorrow, or the day after tomorrow. It makes it pretty hard to structure a society when everything is shifting, when your morality is shifting, when what was good yesterday is no longer good, what was bad yesterday is no longer bad. Chesterton, writing in his book Orthodoxy, had the following to say. He wrote this in 1908. An imbecile habit has arisen in modern controversy of saying that such and such a creed can be held in one age but cannot be held in another. Some dogma, we are told, was credible in the 12th century, but is not credible in the 20th. You might as well say that a certain philosophy can be believed on Monday, but cannot be believed on Tuesday. You may as well say of a view of the cosmos that it is suitable to 3:30, but not suitable to 4:30. What a man can believe depends upon his philosophy, not upon the clock or the century. Close quote. He also pointed out in his treatise Orthodoxy, which I commend to you, still in print, brilliant. He pointed out that the secular attacks on permanent things have not ruined heaven. They've ruined the contemporary condition. The secular attacks on permanent values isn't going to upset the heavenly host, but it certainly can upset how we treat one another, what sort of society we live in. In the same vein, observing the human condition, the French philosopher Joseph de Maistre, and follow this closely, because this again cuts to the quick of what we're talking about. De Maistre stated, "I do not know what the heart of a rascal may be. I know what is in the heart of an honest man. It is horrible." So you see, when we talk about a culture or civilization, what are we talking about? We're talking about the advisable strictures whereby we can live with each other. We can commune with each other. We can do deals with each other. If you don't have that, you don't have the basis for contracts. You know the biggest problem in contemporary Russia today? No understanding of contract law. Paul and I, along with our colleagues and Dr. Douglas, are doing business over there. We are constantly exasperated by the fact that there is no basis for contract law. Because the right or the wrong in the old Soviet Union didn't have anything to do with Western culture's view of right and wrong. It had only to do with what the Communist Party said was right or wrong. And that could shift moment to moment. In the purge trials of Stalin, for example, Malcolm Muggeridge, that great curmudgeon, one of my heroes, who was a reporter for one of the London major dailies during the Stalin show trials of the 1930s, where Stalin was putting on trial all of his former Bolshevik colleagues, walked into the press section and asked one of his colleagues sitting there, "Well, how goes it today?" And the wag responded, "Well, everything is accurate except the truth." I don't see that we're dealing with anything too far afield from that today. I sit and I watch ABC, NBC, CBS, just like you, and I think, yep, it's all accurate except the truth. Now, when we get looking at this philosophical, theological welding and how it has affected and grown up our culture, our society, we study the history, and what do we find? We find that history is basically the study of power, how it's accumulated, how it is dispensed, used, abused, and its effect. I know of no more compelling underlying theme in any historical examination, theological or secular, than the study of the abuses of power. And we talk about power, let me define my terms. One man or group of men's ability to exercise their will over other people, regardless of number. Starting with Cain and Abel, right up to and through the Sanhedrin doing a deal with Pontius Pilate, it is the study of the abuse, accumulation of power. And when you get out of the theological vein and into the secular vein, I don't care whether you read Gibbon and the rise and fall of the Roman Empire. I don't care if you read Toynbee. I don't care if you read Will Durant's 12-volume story of civilization. You find one thing predominating the historic landscape: the accumulation, the use, and abuse of power. And as certain and as valid and as obvious as that is to your own perception of reality, how often is that discussed in contemporary America? It is the forgotten discussion. We have adopted a pagan attitude in this country that once a person is elected to office, they are somehow sanctified like the ancient shamans and immune to the possible uses and abuses of power. And as you study the history, ancient, medieval, and contemporary, what do you find? You find plots, plans, cabals, conspiracies. It's impossible to study history without being struck by all of that. And some of those conspiracies: father against son, son against father, brothers against brothers. And today, while all of history is the study and the observance of power, and more often than not, the conspiracies that brought about the accumulation of power and that abuse of power, that's the one thing we can't talk about today. That's the one thing that will assure you certifiable right-wing extremist tag, is if you happen to believe, could there be a conspiracy going on? Blink, blink. Now, I know, because I've discussed this subject for 30 years, and when I came out of college, I was really no different than most my age. I was a liberal. I was a liberal intellectual, thank you. And how did I know that I was a liberal intellectual? Why? It was simple. I agreed with my professors, who kept reminding me that they were liberal intellectuals. Not a very big stretch. Now, what constituted my liberal intellectualism? Was it the milk of human kindness beating in my veins? Was it this overriding sense of altruism to reach out and touch someone? No. It was best codified by Harry Hopkins, Roosevelt's resident intellectual, who said, people are too damn dumb to know what's good for them. So as a liberal intellectual, I felt that I, along with my fellow intellectuals, needed to structure society in such a way as to take care of these poor buffoons who didn't know what was good for them. And of course, to do that, you must have an abiding love affair. And what is the object of your love? the state. Because when people don't know what's good for them, you have to do something about it. One of the great liberal intellectuals of the age, George Bernard Shaw, in his book, An Intelligent Woman's Guide to Capitalism and Socialism, said in essence, under socialism, and he knew exactly what he was talking about, he wasn't talking about any of this business of counting up, you know, heads and how big is the pie and giving everybody an equal slice. He knew better than that. Shaw was a brilliant critic, cynic, a liberal intellectual. He said, under socialism, you will be mercifully housed, mercifully clothed, mercifully fed, and if you don't like it and you buck, you will be mercifully shot. That's a paraphrase, but it's pretty close to an accurate quote. And along with his fellow liberal intellectual, Shaw created the Fabian Socialist Society. And that's the kind of liberal I was. You want to know how bad? In 1960, I was head of youth for Rockefeller in Spokane, Washington. That's cozying up to power, folks. My mama didn't raise any dumb boys. When I went looking for ways for liberal intellectuals to exercise their power, it didn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that Mr. Rockefeller was a pretty good source. But having had the benefit of a classic education, I was a little put off by one thing. That having studied the history of the ancients and the contemporaries and the medievals, I saw the plots and the cabals and the plans going on. But I was a little puzzled by the fact that we couldn't talk about that in a contemporary vein. That somehow, along around the turn of the century, man became sanctified. That he didn't indulge in all that skullduggery of the past. Pretty hard to juxtapose that idea with the fact that the 20th century is the bloodiest in all human history. But never mind. Don't talk about it. And I was fortunate enough to have a friend, college friend, who was holding some study groups at the time. And I viewed those study groups as simply nothing more than a fascist revival. That's what the liberal intellectuals called conservative anti-communism in those days. Fascist revival. Had visions of anybody of Jewish background being tossed headlong into some oven somewhere. And my friend said, Larry, if we're so wrong, come out, study our material, examine it, and prove it wrong. So I said, okay, you're on. So I went to his study groups and I gathered up his information and his literature about the 20th century. And then I, of course, had to go to the library and start refuting all these things. And then a terrible thing happened. I had to admit something that liberal intellectuals just don't like to admit. I was wrong. I was wrong about a lot of things. There were great big gaping holes in my knowledge base about the 20th century. And an article that I was going to write about this fascist revival in Spokane, that got set aside. I had to find out how wrong was I? How badly had I been misled? How had the process of education through omission shaped my perception of current reality? And the philosophy and the worldview that was going on around us? I'm still finding out. That was 30 years ago. Now I know that of all the things you can discuss today, you can get on television, you can hold seminars and symposia on college campuses, you will receive huge honoraria, appearance fees. You can talk about anything, virtually anything, except one thing. You can't talk about conspiracy. That is the one no-no in all of society. Talk about the relative merits of homosexuality versus heterosexuality? Sure, for sure. In fact, you can get a scholarship for that. Anything. And ironically enough, as a historian, perpetual student of history, I can go out to a college campus or to a PBS studio somewhere or hold an interview with one of the current pillars of wisdom in the national news media. And I can wax eloquent about the conspiracy of Alcibiades in the Peloponnesian Wars. How Alcibiades, the man of great talents and ability and persuasiveness, rose to the top in Athens while part of a conspiracy in Sparta to undermine the Athenians. I can talk about that. I can talk about Catiline and the Catilinian conspiracy during the early Roman epic. I can cite and quote Cicero's great speeches to the Roman Senate about Catiline. Catiline, one of the wealthiest men of all Rome, who put together the first triumvirate, himself, Julius Caesar, Pompey. Wealthy man, honored military man, able politician, the first triumvirate. Sounds like Eisenhower, Nixon, and Rockefeller, but you can't make that comparison. And talk about Catiline and the effects that that conspiracy had on setting the stage for the destruction of Rome as a republic and what that meant as that republic slowly slid into, quote, democracy, close quote, and ultimately empire. We can talk about that. We can talk about the Borgias and the Medici. We can even read Machiavelli and how the exercise of power and deception and cunning shape the Renaissance world. Let me just share a couple paragraphs of Machiavelli with you. So it follows that a prudent ruler cannot and must not honor his word when it places him at a disadvantage and when the reasons for which he made his promise no longer exist. Remember, let me stop here. This is not George Stephanopoulos talking about Bill Clinton. This is Niccolò Machiavelli writing a letter to Lorenzo the Magnificent. Lorenzo de' Medici. Machiavelli was a professor of political science in his age, and he was on the wrong side politically. And he was trying to get back into good graces with the Medici, who had just come to ascendancy. And so the prince was Machiavelli's letter to Lorenzo telling him, look, I'm really smart, I've studied this stuff, and let me share with you some of the things you have to do as a prince if you want to rule properly. That's what it is. Not James Carville, Mandy Grunwald, or George Stephanopoulos, Niccolò Machiavelli. We will continue. If all men were good, remember the preceding sentence, and when the reasons for which he made his promises no longer exist. If all men were good, this precept would not be good. Let me stop. It was assumed by Machiavelli that everybody knew that all men weren't good. Okay? Only in the 20th century have we bought into that sort of sophistry. the opposite I'm pointing to. But because men are wretched creatures who would not keep their word to you, you need not keep your word to them. And no prince ever lacked good excuses to color his bad faith. Anymore, if it looks like you're lying, you go hold a press conference and pick up a baby. How can he be bad if he picks up babies? And Machiavelli says, one could give innumerable modern instances of this, showing how many pacts and promises have been made null and void by the bad faith of princes. Those who have known best how to imitate the fox have come off best. But one must know how to color one's actions and to be a great liar and deceiver. Men are so simple and so much creatures of circumstances that the deceiver will always find someone ready to be deceived. He continues, there is one fresh example I do not want to omit. Alexander VI, one of the immediate predecessors of the age, never did anything or thought of anything other than deceiving men. He always found victims for his deceptions. There never was a man capable of such convincing asseverations or so ready to swear to the truth of something who would honor his word less. Nonetheless, his deceptions always had the result he intended because he was a past master in the art. Solomon was right, folks. There's nothing new under the sun. And when it comes to the political animal, that is certainly true. Now let's jump ahead. We looked at the Borgias. And I might add, when you read Machiavelli in The Prince, or if you read the more extended discourses by that title, Discourses, you'll see that Machiavelli constantly kept pointing out to the histories, the lessons of history that he could cite at the time, particularly Athens and Rome, the conspiracies, the plots, the deceptions. And as an observer of contemporary events at that time, all he was doing was applying those lessons of history as a matrix over which you could lay on that society and come out with a desired end. The accumulation of power. That's all he's talking about here. Why lie unless you got a reason to? It's not easy to lie. Good liars have to remember the lies. You know, it's easier to tell the truth. It's more strategic to lie in most instances. Particularly if you're an honored political man of the moment. Continuing with our examination of conspiracies, I could go before these groups and these audiences. I could talk about the Order of the Rosy Cross, the conspiracies that grew up in 17th century, 18th century Europe, the Jacobins, the German Union, the Order of Illuminati. That would be considered erudite. I would be considered a man of letters. But the minute I start talking about those same applications, those same lessons, and those same conditions in the 20th century, bingo! Right-wing extremists, anti-intellectual, stupid reactionary, and a whole litany of less kind thoughts. Today, the condition reminds me a great deal of what happened during Galileo's time. Remember Galileo through his telescope, concluded that the sun did not revolve around the earth, that the earth revolved around the sun. And can you imagine the controversy that created? So in the interest of preserving the orthodox thought of the day, the inquisitors came out to visit Galileo to get him to recant this heresy. And Galileo said, "Look in my telescope. It's the earth that moves." And they said, "No, we will not look in your telescope because we cannot see what is not there." And that is how contemporary man views this whole idea of plan, cabals, plots, conspiracies. What effect does it have? Galileo, the obedient, bowed his head, apologized, went into his hermitage. His parting shot was, "It's still. It still moves." The nature of man today is no different than it was when Cain slew Abel. The permanent values are the same today as they have always been. And I don't care how many hours of television time, how many thousands of classroom hours, how many millions of books are written, it still moves. And we must build our own worldview, our philosophy, around that idea that man is corruptible and that man's institutions are corruptible, and we have to be forever vigilant, as our founding fathers warned, as every wise man in every age warned. And if we allow the sophists of the day to undermine and permeate our institutions, even our churches, to the point where people lose their ability to assimilate the nature of right from wrong, we lose everything. We have long since passed that moment in time, my friends, where you can say, "Oh, well, there are two things we don't talk about around here, religion and politics." Pardon me. I mean, I can get excited about the Seattle Supersonics for 10 minutes. And I like Payne Stewart's golf swing as well as the next guy. But if you're going to rule out religion and politics, I don't want to talk to you. You're boring. And you can verily trace America's decline when that little cliche became part of America's business community. "Oh, we don't talk about religion and politics around here. Might cost us some customers, you see. I've discussed nothing but religion and politics for 30 years and cost me any customers." Because right now, you can decide you don't want to talk about religion and politics, but the people waging war against your culture, your civilization, your beliefs, they are talking about it. They have waged and are declaring war. Did any of you happen to watch April 25 C-SPAN coverage of the homosexual march on Washington? For 6 hours, I sat there and watched that. It was brutal to watch, wasn't it? My job. And I listened to Urashi Vaid, former head of the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force. Ms. Vaid drew a line in the sand. She said, "Our enemies are are the Christians and the monotheists, and we must fight them at every level. Remember that comment? We must fight them at every level of government. Their irreligion, which they believe in so passionately, has now been irrevocably bound up in the political process. What is this revolution all about? One of their own writers, Frank Browning, said, sex is what this revolution is all about. The free use of it. So you see, they're plotting, they're planning, they have an agenda, and most of us have been convinced, or are convinced, or are in the process of being convinced, that if you talk about these things as part of a grand scheme, you are somehow less than intelligent. I will tell you categorically, I have traveled the world, I have met an awful lot of interesting people, and anybody who rules out the role of conspiracy in the contemporary machinations of the political process is not smart. They're dumb. They're like the inquisitors who met with Galileo. They refuse to look in the telescope because it's not there. Let's take a coffee break.
Oh, really?